Whether it's a loving romance or a devastating war, we all know what it's like to get caught up in something bigger than ourselves. Maybe you go back and forth trying to carry everyone's burdens, all the while losing touch with your own humanity. How do we find the strength to keep going? How do we not give in to feelings of hatred and nihilism? On today's episode of the Live a Meaningful Story podcast, we'll explore a layered and magical fantasy about appearances, forging a new kind of family, and finding strength through compassion in times of war. Howl's Moving Castle is a film adaptation by legendary anime director Hayao Miyazaki. 20 years after its release, it maintains a polarizing position in Studio Ghibli's filmography, with some hailing it as a layered masterpiece, while others think of it as a gorgeous yet convoluted mess. But within these archetypes contain ideas ranging from vanity to pacifism that are relevant for our world today. But at the heart of this tale is a journey towards giving your heart to someone else, no matter how heavy it might be to bear. And how if you love others above yourself, you can do great things, even when the world around you is falling apart. Welcome to the Live a Meaningful Story podcast, where we analyze stories and films that help us make sense of life. We are four friends with backgrounds in storytelling, filmmaking, teaching, and narrative therapy. Join us on our quest towards telling and living our stories more meaningfully. I'm Derek Hatch.
My name is Nick Natal.
Hello, hello, everybody. I'm Joseph Wilson.
I'm Jason Lin.
All right, so we are doing our final episode in this series on acceptance, and we've done the romance of past lives, we've done the war in Fury, and now we're bringing them together. And I remember us texting and being like, how is Howl's Moving Castle going to fit into this? And I'm like, oh boy, it does. It literally will tie these things in together.
I did not realize that until very, very recently.
Yeah. So it's a good pairing. So unfortunately, you guys will notice that Joe is not here for this episode. He will be back, obviously, on the next one.
He hates this movie. So he said, no,
we didn't get his opinion.
Nah, it's not, he gave me his opinion. He loved it.
He loved it? Oh, man, that's a bummer that he couldn't be here then. Tori and I did two episodes on Studio Ghibli in when it was the All Things Narrative podcast. But this is the first time that we've described a Studio Ghibli film. So this is going to be really interesting. So let's go ahead and dive into it. I'll start with the Letterboxd description. When Sophie, a shy young woman, is cursed with an old body by a spiteful witch, her only chance of breaking the spell lies with a self-indulgent yet insecure young wizard and his companions in a legged walking castle. So, Miyazaki, we saw The Boy and the Heron in theaters. And what did you guys think of that one?
Fun. I thought it was cool.
That was your first one.
There's a lot going on. That was a messier movie than this one.
So as I was watching this one, I was thinking of The Boy and the Heron, and I like The Boy and the Heron better.
Yeah.
Sorry, what word are you saying?
Herod,
Heron.
Heron?
Heron? Heron? Heron?
I don't know. The Boy and the Bird.
The Boy and the Bird. So then that was your first one. Yeah. And then you saw this and Spirited Away, right?
Yeah, I'm three in now.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about Miyazaki and him making this film, because the backstory of all this is quite interesting of how this film even came to be. We know that Miyazaki, this theme of war is very close to his heart. So when he was 3 years old, him and his family fled. This is like early 1940s here. There was a firebomb that was destroying their village, kind of like the scene in The Boy and the Heron. And there was somebody that was running. And it was a mother and her child, and they were crying out and asking for it was like some kind of like cargo truck or something like that they were on, and they were full. They didn't have any more room. And this mother and the child were chasing the vehicle, trying to catch up and begging for it to stop. And they just kept going. And so that moment has always haunted him for that, even though he was only 3 years old. We fast forward to 2003, and the next film they're making is Howl's Moving Castle, which originally he was not even supposed to be the director for. It was another director. But he has this habit of taking over projects when he thinks he can do them better than whoever's there. So this is another case of that. But really what really made him want to take on this project was when America got involved in the Middle East and the Iraq War. Something he was so opposed to that he did not accept his Academy Award for Spirited Away when he won it, because he was that opposed to what America was doing. with Howl's Moving Castle, he makes a shift in his career where he says, I'm no longer going to try to make films that appeal to a Western audience. I want to make things that are more layered, more complex. And it's interesting because he has on record said that this is his favorite film that he's ever made. Didn't say it was his best film, but he said this is his personal favorite. So what were your guys' initial thoughts as you were seeing it?
Well, the first time I watched it, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the castle.
Yeah.
I thought Hal was a funny character. I thought the group of characters were really fun. That little family of outcasts, Turnip Head, Michael. Yeah.
The little Calcifer. Boy who puts the hood over and pretends to be the
long
man.
Beard. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of Calcifer. It's just a bunch of craziness, which is what I like.
Yeah, this is the best cast of characters, I think, in any Ghibli film.
I had a different experience the second time I watched it. The second time, it felt a little slower and longer.
Yeah.
And so right before we were talking about Eastern and Western filmmaking, so I'm really interested to discover that.
Yeah.
Because the second time was a different experience. It went down a little bit for me.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think, was it just the pacing or was there other reasons it went down?
So I don't mind slow movies. I like slow movies, but there's something about this that is kind of like, the word I was using was sleepy. It was just a very different kind of vibe. And it may have to do with the Eastern filmmaking, but there was not a lot of momentum. And my experience with a lot of Studio Ghibli films is the visuals are overwhelming to me. There's so much happening that it's hard for me to get excited, I think.
Super busy, so much going on, and there's a lot that doesn't get explained in a lot of this guy's movies.
There's a good and bad, but I don't mind just like crazy silliness. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot to Howl that's there that I like.
Yeah.
Watching this the second time was really more of the first time because I had seen, it's basically all I had known were impressions of how the movie had felt or what I remembered seeing, just the characters, the Scarecrow kind of hopping around.
Yeah, Turnip Head.
But there was a lot of things that most of the whole movie I experienced for the first time and it was new. And I really enjoyed Sophie as a character.
Yeah.
Sophie is awesome.
I think it's one of his best protagonists.
Yeah, I think she's one of the strongest and the least subtle. And I think I liked it that way. And there's a lot going on in this one. It's not just one concept. And I think that's in a lot of his movies. It's a multifaceted story and life's like that. But there's greed. There's the concept of giving your heart to someone else or the weight of your own heart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's appearance, beauty, things that you can't change. I liked how the magic and the wizards and stuff was not like a surprise in this movie, and that's what caught me off guard.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, she floated down from onto the balcony.
Yeah, it just accepts that magic's part of this
world. It's like, oh, these things just happen.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just a lot of cool themes, and I really like, and I really see the concept of flight. After this movie, I agree with you, he's either fascinated, terrified, or just completely like both about birds.
Oh yeah. Wait till I get to the bird part.
The cane is a bird.
Uh-huh.
The hat that she comes in with, that her mom comes in with, is like a big bird on it.
Mm-hmm.
Howl
turns into a bird.
Yeah. The monster, like the wizards that turn themselves into monsters that fly around, they're like frogs with wings.
Yeah.
They like flight is a terrifying concept and it's a freeing concept. Yep. And then freedom is another big theme in this. But this that's just kind of the general impression, but a breathtakingly beautiful movie, like the meadow, I just think that he's really good at showing these beautiful, sprawling, glittering scenes and also just a perversion.
Yeah.
Like the castle itself is ugly.
Right.
Howl's.
It's just this patchwork of pieces that are situated. And that's a metaphor, kind of like Fury, right? Fury, the tank represents the family and each role they play. Mm-hmm. The castle likewise represents this new family coming together, this patchwork. And then when the castle falls apart later, the family is at risk of falling apart and they have to figure out how to mend it back.
Mm-hmm. It's also a reflection of Howl and his mental state.
Yes,
and
yes.
I've thought about, okay, he's
the war daddy of the castle.
Yeah. So I thought about that, the whole tantrum about his beauty, and I saw something online that I thought was interesting, so I'm kind of drawn from that too.
Yeah.
But he is deeply depressed.
Yeah.
And there is a deep hollowness in, most if not all of the past few movies we've done, Fury and
Past Lives.
Past Lives.
Mm-hmm.
But Hal is just running. He's just running the whole time.
Yeah.
He can make himself beautiful. And on the outside, he seems beautiful.
Right.
But yeah, he's slowly becoming more of a monster. His life is a mess.
Right.
Markle even tells us, I can't remember the last time I had an actual breakfast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And all these things are being hinted at. And when he loses the one thing he has control over, it's all gone.
Yeah.
And I thought the way that was depicted, I've got a lot of thoughts. We'll probably get
to them.
This is my first.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's a good start
rant
there. I'll kind of go into the stuff about Eastern storytelling, and then that'll help us take it, through
you do have that.
Help
nice.
Us go through the film, yeah.
Oh, I see Calcifer is the first name I saw.
Calcifer on my notes.
Oh my gosh. Calcifer
is the heart of the film in a way.
Literally. I understand why your daughters like him.
They haven't even seen this movie, but
what?
they just love Calcifer.
Oh, on the screen?
They love seeing, yeah.
That's funny.
But so there's two key things in Japanese and Eastern storytelling in general that differentiate from West. Now, just keep in mind, when I say Western storytelling, I'm talking about traditional Western storytelling. No subversions, no postmodern twists, like just traditional Western storytelling that tends to either be a three-act structure or a five-act structure.
I didn't know there was five.
Yeah, usually you see that more in novels, like in Shakespeare and more long-form storytelling. There are certain, like Tarantino uses a five-act structure, so certain filmmakers do it. But in Japan and in the East, it's a four-act structure. So there's two big differences. So one is that Western stories tend to emphasize overcoming external conflict. So internal conflict is worked out so that the larger external conflict can get worked out. In the East, it's reversed. So the primary conflict in an Eastern story tends to be internal in nature. So you have to ask, what is the internal conflict? And the externals are just meant to kind of
pull it out
internal. In different ways.
That's like Past Lives.
Yeah, so Past Lives actually very much does use a more Eastern compared to a Western, at least in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It uses a three-act structure, but it emphasizes that more. So like in Howl's Moving Castle, the central conflict is Sophie's curse. Now, you might think that that's an external thing that's placed on her, but actually in a minute when we get into it, it actually is an internal thing that what the witch did brought out of her. And it's something that she has to deal with. The second major difference is the storytelling structure itself. And this might explain the pacing for you. Typically tends to be four acts. So the first act is called the ki or the kai. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's been a while since I've read this stuff. But basically, this is all very much similar to the first act in the West. You introduce your setting, your characters, your inciting incident, right? Pretty much the same there. Now, the introductions can be longer, they can be shorter, but what's different is the second act. The second act is called the show, and the show is also called development. So it takes everything in the first act and just develops it further. That's all it does. So it develops the characters more, it develops the setting more, it helps you understand the situation better. So this kind of is that lull that you might feel because the development tends to be the longest act.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Miyazaki can do an act two that's an hour where you're just in this place of just developing things, right? Then the last two acts come really quick. There's the 10, which introduces some sort of twist. So the twist comes later. And so the twist in Howl's, at least from what I understand it, is all the stuff when we get to the heart and we get to this weird time travel sequence, right? And the movie starts to go, where's Hal's heart? What role is Sophie meant to play? That's the twist. So if the act two, the development, begins with Sophie getting the curse, becoming old, and then it doesn't end until that sequence where the castle is going to be destroyed and she, that think of how long of them that is in the movie, right? Where all we're doing is developing. We're just developing characters. We're just, right? And then there's the twist. This is where the conflict, the internal conflict is solved. And then the last part is the ketsu. And that's basically where we kind of revisit things in the beginning, but now we see a new status quo move forward. So in The Boy and the Heron, the last act is 1 minute.
I'm pretty sure.
1 minute for the last act.
In the three act structures, it's inciting incident, first act climax.
Rising action, yeah. Climax, falling action,
same for
resolution.
Same for the second act and the third act, right?
So those are the five, like for the five acts there. And then the three acts basically put those together in different ways. But like our resolutions tend to be a good like 10 minutes-ish in a movie, right? Where you have all the height of the problem, but then we kind of get some breathing room to kind of, right? In a lot of these Miyazaki films, it's really quick. Oh, she calls the war off? Oh, I guess we'll just call this silly war off. They're flying in the sky in the castle. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. They're very quick resolutions. So
yes,
does that kind of explain a bit more like the structure? So if we move through this story, if we move through Howl's, it's interesting because like, let's see how some of these themes play out here. So you start off with this dialogue that's basically all gossip and rumors about Howl. Like Howl. Who is this
Ripping
Howl figure?
Girls' house, hearts.
Yeah. And it's already like you're starting off with propaganda. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. Like, because you're introducing this war theme through, like, you're just smothered with propaganda the first few minutes. The parade outside, and Sophie's just trying to stay in her own little corner.
Trying to make hats.
She's trying to just kind of stay away from all that stuff. But she's going to get sucked into the war, whether she realizes it or not. Kind of like Norman in Fury. She's going to get sucked in. So when she meets Howl, they have that awesome sequence where they're walking in the sky, right? That moment where she's with Howl and she starts to see things that she couldn't see before. So there's like a spiritual, magical reality that opens up for her that maybe she was oblivious to before. But that also opens her up to both the enchantments of Howl, but also the Witch of the Waste, right? It opens her up to the potential of darkness to enter as well. And the Witch of the Waste is jealous because she wants Howl's heart. Because we learn later that she has a curse too, where she's holding back a curse, I should say, because she's really old, but she's trying to mask herself with beauty to look young. And that's kind of what Howl struggles with, except Howl really is young. Mm-hmm. And but so she wants to possess that youthfulness. And so she wants to take that. And she sees Sophie as a threat to that. Already in the first 10, 15 minutes, we're in this fantasy world. But yet there's so many ideas in the real world that it's grounded in, you know? There's so many things that my mind goes to that when we think of, it's not just escapism. It's actually meant to help us engage our world. Yeah.
More with reality.
Exactly. So then we get to the long development here, right? We come into this world and we just try to make the best of it. And so Sophie gets this curse and she's old and she kind of just takes it in stride. She doesn't really like try to fight it, or she just kind of accepts it. And that's kind of where some of the comedy comes. I think this is his funniest movie.
Well, what I thought was funny, and this is my take on it, is that her personality didn't necessarily change. Her mind didn't. It was almost an outlet to express herself, actually.
Yeah, because she has that line where she says like, oh, now my... Doesn't she have a line?
Now
like,
I dress
like,
finally
now
suits
Now I dress
me.
Finally suits me, yes.
And so she's witty, she is bold, and the thing about her own beauty had hung her up. And I wonder if, you know, her becoming old, it was just like, well, whatever, fine. I don't even have to worry about this anymore. And she just charged into the wilds.
Well,
because it's like, all right, I wouldn't go out there if I were you. All right, thanks. I'll keep it in mind.
Yeah.
She just goes and.
Well, even her name is an old soul kind of name because Sophie literally means wisdom, right? It's where we get the word for wisdom there.
That.
So,
is,
like her having the gray hair, right?
Yes.
Like,
that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah. That's that. It. She actually embodies her name more when she's older. Well, actually, we'll see that there's a way that her two identities are fully reconciled later. But then she meets Turnip Head, who's one of my favorite characters. He's fun. Just this mute scarecrow that just tries to help.
He's sweet. He's a kind
dude. He is sweet. He's got a bad curse on him, but he's sweet, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then we get to the castle, and that's where we get Howl. So we get Howl, Markle, and Calcifer there, right? And as individual characters, they're all just kind of there. Yeah. They're just passive. They're just kind of doing their thing. But then we're going to see how all of them being in this castle pushes them forward. Now, one of my favorite scenes is when Sophie is cooking breakfast on Calcifer, and she's taking charge in the castle. And Calcifer has that great line, "Hope all your bacon burns."
Yeah.
So great cast, by the way, too. Like just the voice cast, like for the English dub, I think this is definitely one of my favorite. And Christian Bale is Howl. And this is actually where he found his Batman voice.
Yeah, that's what I said when I was watching it. I said, oh, there's Batman voice right there.
Yep, that's where he finds it, right? That scene where he's the monster.
Yeah.
So, and it's funny because the English version of this movie came out the same week as Batman Begins.
That is
true. Obviously, Batman Begins was number one. I think this was number like 13 or something like that.
Hey.
This movie financially did not do well in America, but it gained like this weird critical status. Like I remember like in middle school, people were obsessed with this movie, especially like in the emo subculture because everybody identified
loved Howl.
Yep. You remember that too?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, so there's the scene where they're cooking breakfast, and breakfast meal scenes are never just about the meal. They're always trying to communicate something bigger. So we talked about in Fury, they're having a meal, right? And that's trying to expose this family, like this humanity family dynamic they're trying to have but can't. You know, past lives, they're having this meal at the bar where they're trying to figure out their place. And in here, it's the same thing. The meal is really about that line where Markle says, I don't remember the last time we had a meal like this. Sophie is bringing something vital to this family. It's not just breakfast. She's bringing a sense of order to them. She's bringing the feminine touch, which is something that all of Miyazaki's feminine protagonists really are trying to do. They're trying to have a healthy, aspirational view of femininity and how to bring that in, right? So she's bringing that in because she's like a weird, like mother, grandmotherly figure, but she's also like a love interest too. So she's supposed to be. Yeah, she is the caretaker archetype. Yeah, exactly.
Definitely. And at the end, she's like, I figure out how to help you.
Yes.
That line kind of made me mad.
But that's all she wants, right? I mean, listen to the description here. So the caregiver archetype motivates empathy, compassion, and a desire to help through providing comfort, nurturance, and practical assistance where it is needed. And in this way, to accomplish the caring functions needed for a human community to flourish. That's Sophie. That's her whole arc in the movie, right? Is to embrace this role. But in order to do so, she has to deal with her own curse. But there's these moments where she goes back and forth between being old and being young. So what do you think is the significance of that?
Well, I was wondering if the more she's in love, she starts to become young again. But there's times when she's sleeping and she's young. And there's times, I was wondering, there didn't seem to be any rhythm to it.
Yeah. What do you think, Jason?
I don't know, because I noticed that too. But it must be something including love, but also not exclusive to it. In her sleep, she's free. She's doesn't have, I don't know. Because when you're asleep, you're free of all emotions, right?
Yeah.
It's peace.
Yeah.
So maybe it's when she's at peace or I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, I think it's a twofold. I think, yes, I think you're right. I think it's a love for Howl, but I think it's also a love and a peace with herself, right? Mm-hmm. Because even when she's old, she accepts that that's where she's at, but she doesn't fully accept herself yet. She accepts what she's supposed to do, but she doesn't accept who she is. Because again, that Eastern storytelling, we're looking inward, right? What is the internal conflict? And Sophie and Howl both are insecure about themselves. So that moment, one of my favorite moments when Howl, the hair dye, which by the way, very personal for me because that actually did happen to me when I was in, I think, 10th grade, when I was 16. My hair, legit, I went in to get it dyed. It was supposed to be blonde. And it turned orange.
That's really
and I had a meltdown, just like Howl, where I was just like,
life is not worth living.
Yes. I was so insecure at that age. And when my hair got turned orange, I was devastated. Absolutely wrecked. I remember I would wear a hat when I went out because I just did not
cut it all off.
Well, I fortunately was able to get some of it cut off, and then some of it, we were able to fix it and get it blonde. But I had a meltdown, like a huge freak out.
That's how it literally melted down.
Yeah, he literally melts, and then he calls the spirits of darkness, which I think that image is fascinating. So we melt down in these moments of insecurity and all that, and there's no point in living if I can't be beautiful. Yeah. There's a weird comedy to it.
He literally put his own heart at risk.
Yeah. But then he puts the whole castle at risk because he calls the spirit of darkness. And I love that image of how your own insecurities, your own darkness can destroy the family around you if you don't deal with it.
Yeah, and like it impinges on everybody else. So Sophie's like, I've never been beautiful.
When she runs out of the castle and has that moment where she cries, this is my favorite moment in the whole film because I think this moment is so profoundly real in a way that fantasy like connects with reality. So that moment when she's out there and she's crying because she's like, I've never been beautiful before.
Is that when Turnip Head comes with the umbrella?
Because Turnip Head is that aspirational compassion, and he subtly reminds Sophie of what she's called to do. So she gets connection with an outside force.
She can come
back. And then she can go back into the situation and deal with it level-headed.
All right, I'm starting to like this movie a little bit.
I mean, it's so good,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it is.
I also really like the way how attempts to not just look, but act. Mm-hmm. So every time he's on screen, he's like charismatic, lighthearted, confident. The way he acts is just, he knows everything that's going on. And
he looks like he has it all together.
Yeah, even the way he says, that woman terrifies me. I need you to be there. Like, it's not said with any, not necessarily weight, but like he's, I don't know if lofty is the right word. He's very like bright about it.
Yeah.
And about the things he said. And I thought the scene where he's just in his room and it's just covered with all this magic.
Yeah.
And all this other stuff. And he's like, all this magic is just to keep everybody away. I just run and run.
Yeah.
And he's got the knives and the stuff thrown into that contract on his wall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the way the castle just kind of creaks and groans, and it's bound to the ground.
Yeah.
Like it can go up onto
the... It can't actually soar yet.
It can go onto the mountains and you can walk really, really high up. And Calcifer is really strong, and it moves the castle. It moves the rest, I guess, of his body around.
Right.
But... it's not until the end where the castle's flying now. And
right.
It looks cleaner. It doesn't look so clunky and noisy.
Well, Hal would fall under the magician archetype.
That's really funny.
Yeah, it actually is a real archetype. But the mission, listen to what this is, though. And this is one of my main archetypes, so I relate a lot to Hal. And my wife has the caregiver archetype. So we love this movie. This is like a staple in our house. Magician archetype motivates a powerful desire to infuse meaning and mattering into everyday life, mending what is broken, realizing dreams, and transforming what is into what could be. So that's what Hal is doing, because Hal does have this vision for a better life. Now, there's two opposing sides that are trying to draft Hal into the war, right? Now, what happens is that the wizards, when they go and fight, when they fight long enough, they start to turn in to these strange bird things. It's called a Kotingu. It's a Japanese mythological bird that symbolizes overconfidence and arrogance and heading towards destruction. Howl, every time he goes and fights in this war, and again, he's not trying to take a side. And this is something interesting about Miyazaki's male protagonists, is they tend to have a hard time taking a side. And this is actually the magician archetype. One of the things it says is that they could see all sides of an argument. And so it can be hard for them to take a stand, which I relate to that as well. So with Howl, he just destroys the weapons of war, but doesn't want to destroy any of the people on any sides. He even has that line when they're in the garden and Sophie says, whose ship is it, theirs or ours? And he said, what difference does it make? Like, that's Howl's character there, right? That's how he treats this war there.
And but, he doesn't kill any of the people on it or destroy it. Right. He just slowly
crashes it.
Right. But every time he does that, every time he goes and fights, it gets harder for him to turn back human. He's that bird form is more a part of him, to that point where Sophie tries to find him in the dark corridor and he's completely that monster bird creature, right? We see in that moment that that's what Hal can become. He can potentially become this creature of destruction. The war can do this to him. It can consume him. And so Sophie has to find a way to get him his heart back. That's another theme, is this idea of a heart and as a burden. Hal, even though he has compassion, he's lost his heart. And that's what Sophie has to get back. Because if you're giving compassion, if you're just giving, but your heart's not in it, then you're going to lose your humanity. And that's what Hal's at risk of doing. And so Sophie has to go and find the heart. And that's when she learns, which it's taken me a few times watching this film to figure out what the heck is happening. When Sophie is like going back in time and seeing, right?
Childhood.
His childhood. So Hal takes a shooting star and then
he eats it.
Eats it and then gets magic abilities.
But the star becomes, like, takes his heart, though.
Right. So Calcifer, you know, takes the heart in and of himself. And that heart, again, is what's keeping the castle alive. If you remove Calcifer and the heart, the castle implodes. It crumbles. And so Sophie is able to, through her compassion within this setting, and she's able to, with Calcifer, get the heart back while also preserving Calcifer, which nobody was able to do. And this is where, you know, Sophie turns into this form where she looks young, but her hair is old, is gray, mm-hmm. right? So she's been able to reconcile them at this point, her youth, her beauty, but then also her wisdom and compassion become one identity. And I love that she doesn't completely change back to being young.
It's integrated.
She's integrated. That's a good way of putting it.
But by her hair, that's the first time that Sophie's called beautiful in the movie by Hal.
Yes.
Hal says, your hair looks like starlight. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And she's old when when he says that.
Yeah.
In the garden.
Yeah.
And there's small like hints at who she is and her compassion too. Like it's obvious in a lot of ways, but even in when there's the three utensils and there's two spoons and one fork, and what are you going to eat bacon and eggs with? Not a spoon, but that's what she takes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I still think it's interesting that he took on Markle as an apprentice to begin with. Like he wants family. He doesn't want to be alone.
Yeah. I think Markle definitely shows that. And then. The way he's able to find a role for Turniped, even though he's like, your curse is so bad, I don't know if I want to let you in the castle.
That's what he says, yeah. Right? This is too much.
This is too much. Because he recognized, like, it's all about carrying burdens. Hal's carrying these burdens of the people in the castle. Even his ex-girlfriend, in a way, you know? Where he was like, that's I thought wild. She was beautiful, but she was really ugly, you know?
So I ran away.
He's just running away from everything. But he's learning how to carry those burdens. And even though Hal has all the magic, he's the most lost one. And even though Sophie, you know, is the one with the curse, she's the one who has the power to make the best of it and to be able to restore this family here.
She has the magic.
Yeah, she has a different kind of magic, right? And then we get to the end where we realize that, you know, Sophie, by pulling this scarecrow out of a bush by that act of compassion of just helping this thing, then the scarecrow's along for the ride, then she kisses Turniped, and then it turns out that he's the lost prince, that the whole war is over. Madame Sullivan just casually says, all right, let's just end this war.
And Sophie's his long-lost love, which isn't requited. And he's like, well, we can always count on the one thing that hearts always change.
Yes.
That's what he says at the
yes.
end.
Yeah. And I mean, that's
all better now.
That's a lot of Miyazaki's
war. I'll be back later for you.
That's a lot of Miyazaki's war commentary in there as well. Is like, this could just be called off at any time, but we choose not to.
I like the president or the king.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's definitely some political jab. Like some people have theory that the king and Madame Sullivan are supposed to represent like American politics. Like the king is just kind of like derpy and
kind of war hungry.
Yeah, but when Hal pretends to be the king, she sees it's fake because Hal's trying to be all elegant and all that. And we see the real king, and he's kind of an idiot.
I wouldn't say idiot, but he's just, like, not at all as poised.
No, he's not impressive.
We'll beat him to a pulp.
Yep. Yeah, kind of George Bushy.
Yeah.
Lotso in Toy Story 3.
But yeah, but all, it's funny because they're ultimately trying to avoid this war, but then Sophie helping this scarecrow, it's low-key what ends the war there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the castle's able to soar. They're able to live together as a family. Their colors change. If you look at their clothes in the final shot, they all are wearing different colors. The colors they were wearing versus what they wear, it's all signifying change.
It's interesting that small act of kindness of helping Turnip Head in the beginning mm-hmm. is what ends the war.
Right.
He's saying just this little act can stop this huge thing.
Right. So, I don't know. Any other thoughts on this movie?
There's a whole lot of symbolism.
Yeah, it's layered. Mm-hmm. It's very layered.
I think one of my favorite scenes is when Madame Sullivan and Sophie and Hal and the witch are all together and she does the thing where she taps her staff and like the ocean comes out and it shows.
Oh, yeah.
The scene
so
with
cool.
with the fallen stars like dancing around and Hal becomes like the monster and she snaps him out of it. The music and the imagery was just really cool and beautiful.
Miyazaki's a master at really beautiful imagery and then also colliding that with really disturbing, haunting things.
Another thing with Sophie in the end where she asks the witch the ways for the heart back.
Mm-hmm.
And all she does is hug her and say, please.
Yeah.
And just her compassion or vulnerabilities.
The empathy, because she's like, I know how much this means to you.
Just please. And she gets it. I thought that was the culmination of her character right there.
Yeah. Well, every character is changed by the end of the film in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Sophie is able to, you know, love herself.
Everyone.
And love everyone. Hal's able to, same thing, right? Because Hal has that line where he says, like, I now have something worth fighting for.
Yeah, you.
Yeah. And then you've got even the Witch of the Waste is able to let go of her desire for beauty and youth.
Her greed.
And her greed. Yeah.
She gave something away that she wanted to possess.
Yeah. Everybody changed. Even Calcifer becomes, instead of being this confined to this thing and says, oh, I can't do this, I can't do that all the time, right? He's able to lift the castle. He's able to be outside the castle. And then he's finally able to just be free as is and not be bound to anything else.
It's cool. That's Sophie's interaction with Hal's heart that we're seeing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. On an archetypal level.
She's like encouraging his heart. And when
his heart is free.
When he feeds her hair, that he gets super strong and starts moving it.
Mm-hmm.
Like he was attracted to her hair, he goes, imagine if you had given me your eyes or something else.
What I could do.
That's what Hal sees in Sophie. Like her eyes, her heart, her hair, like that's what he sees as beautiful.
That's what Hal needed was her hair, the wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, her wisdom, the way she sees things, her eyes, her kind eyes, and her compassionate heart.
This movie's deep.
Yeah.
Has it gone up a notch for you since Soggy?
No, it has. It has. I needed that.
Yeah.
Because on first watch, you can miss all of that. It's so overwhelming, the visuals. Yeah. And this is the least overwhelming of his movies that I've seen so far.
Yeah.
So the pace, the structure, and the visuals can really, you could lose it.
I think that's why a lot of people like to return to Ghibli films in terms of rewatchability, is that there's so much, you almost have to have a different kind of storytelling hat when you're watching it. Because again, I'm thinking more Eastern when I'm watching. I'm not judging it by a Western criteria, but also I'm looking at it very symbolically. As you should with any fantasy work, but Miyazaki, everything he's doing is so intentional symbolically. And so you have to really take the time to figure out what's all going on. But it's a great movie. And I think there's always a lot to talk about in these films. So I look forward to doing more in the future. If you want to do a deep dive more into the world of storytelling, but get better understanding it, getting a craft of it, visit allthingsnarrative.com because we've got workshops that we offer, including a workshop that I did recently on analyzing films, talking about the hero's journey, talking about how do we analyze archetypes, symbolism, and stories. If that's a workshop that you'd be interested in, whether it be a group that you know, or whether you're in the Palm Beach County area and you want to do it in person, or you want to do something via Zoom, go ahead and check out the link here in the show notes, and you'll see that you can actually fill out a little form just to tell us more about what you're interested in. And I'd love to get a free consultation with you and see if you'd be interested in learning more about storytelling via these workshops. And we will be back next month for a new batch of films. And until next time, guys, take care. Thank you for listening to the Live a Meaningful Story podcast, produced by All Things Narrative. If you'd like to learn more about our coaching, workshops, events, please check out allthingsnarrative.com. You can also follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at All Things Narrative. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing and leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and tune in next time as we continue exploring the stories we love and the stories we live. Take care.